Welcome to Alex and Annie, the real women of vacation rentals. With more than 35 years combined industry experience, Alex Huesner and Annie Holcomb have teamed up to connect the dots between inspiration and opportunity, seeking to find the one story, idea, strategy, or decision that led to their guests' big aha moment. Join them as they highlight the real stories behind the people and brands that have built vacation rentals into the $100 billion industry it is today. And now, it's time to get real and have some fun with your hosts, Alex and Annie.
Welcome to Alex and Annie, the real women of vacation rentals. I'm Alex.
And I'm Annie.
And we are joined today with Katie Briscoe, who is the CEO of MMGY Global, which is a $100 million integrated travel marketing firm that operates all around the world. Katie, it's so great to see you today.
Oh, it's so good to see you both. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. So one of the things that we talked about off camera that we like to do within Alex and Annie is we like to bring on people that are unexpected, people that are from different facets of not just tourism, but just of other industries, and really explore like the synergies between our business and the guest business. You're in global tourism. You're in Kansas City. So you're in a very big destination. You work with a lot of destinations, but I would venture to say most of our listeners probably don't know much about Katie Briscoe or MMG. So I wondered if you could just give us a little bit about your history, your background, and how you got into tourism.
Absolutely. Well, I'll start with the company because the company is as old as I am. It started really in travel, more on the hospitality side. So while we do a tremendous amount of work with destination marketing organizations, you know, a third of our portfolio is in the private sector, in hospitality, in transportation, basically any facet of the travel industry, that really the travel, hospitality, or many lifestyle brands we work with too, we service. So we've been at this for sort of 40 years. I've been with the company for 15. And the company has transformed, certainly, both in scale, but also in expertise in terms of the global team. We now have 600 employees around the world, and we have 14 global offices. And in fact, we used to say headquartered in Kansas City, but I think the goal in being a truly global company was having more, you know, associates outside of the U.S. than in, and we're really nearing that benchmark, which is exciting. You know, I grew up in the company. For the first half of my tenure, the company was privately owned by Don Montague and Clayton Reed. And then in 2016, you know, it was really an inflection point of if the company was going to grow or sort of stay this sort of same size and be a smaller agency partner to clients. I think many of us who had grown up in the business and knew what we could do were really, you know, excited to start investing in other businesses and, you know, capital investments and service lines. And so we took the company to market, and we were invested in by a company called Peninsula Capital Partners out of Detroit, Michigan. And so for the last 7.5 years of Peninsula's holding, they've been phenomenal partners. Didn't know much about travel, didn't know much about our business, but were just great business partners and really trusted the management team, which is the dream in any sort of transaction like that. You know, we've been able to invest in 11 businesses over the course of Peninsula's holding, 6 of those being outside the U.S. So truly became a global business. Not, it wasn't just the sign on the door.
Yeah.
And more than half of those businesses have been small women-owned businesses. So I pinch myself every day that we now have a field of 19 founders tied to our global business, our global platform, that have spearheaded thought leadership, you know, research efforts across the travel industry. I think about the exposure to that caliber of thinking, and I just can't believe I have the opportunity to be a part of it. So I became CEO last January. I worked my way up nearly every job in the agency, but came up through the client service side, which I think if you poke around a lot of executive teams in agencies, a lot come up through the account management side, because at the end of the day, we're customer service company and obviously trying to drive real outcomes. We're not a vanity shop. We like awards, but it's not a traditional shop in which the awards are paramount to our success. It really truly is about, you know, growing clients' business, growing their share of wallet, really expanding their brand profile at a national or regional, national, or global scale. So yeah, that's sort of how I came up in the firm. Again, the agency is such a special place to work. And now that I've been inside travel, I can't imagine doing anything else. And I think even coming out of the pandemic, you know, where people probably ask the two of you, I'm sure, are you going to stay in the travel and hospitality industries? Given what's happened, it's never going to be the same. And I'm sure you had the same answer that I did, which is, of course, travel is this part of the human experience. travel changes everything. Why would we step away from that? And we can see now with consumer behavior coming out of pandemic, the moment people were able to travel, they prioritized what they're spending those experiences.
I think it's a matter of saying, like, it's not that I have to, I get to. You know, I always look at it like we get to be part of people's experiences, both the first times, the last times, the in-between times, but we're part of their memories, whether we're actually active in it or not. We get to be memory makers and participate in that. And that's an honor.
Oh, so I completely agree. Such an honor to be a part of these. You know, when you ask people, this is the age old, and we have research that supports this now of this sort of priority, especially coming out of the pandemic, of experiences, not things. You know, you saw a lot of, at the beginning of the pandemic, consumers, you know, renovating homes and, you know, really shifting those, you know, they're not going out to eat at restaurants. They're not taking vacations. They're spending in other ways, but there's only so many big screen TVs you can buy. There's only, you know, it's like that meaningful. And so ultimately when you ask people about, you know, their favorite memories or experiences, it's typically always tied to travel. I like now check this when I'm talking to people and getting to know them and, you know, leaning in that whole mantra of it's more interesting to be interested. I always am asking, you know, people like, tell me about your, you know, your favorite experiences. And it always comes back to a travel experience, 9 times out of 10.
Yeah. Makes sense. I mean, we talk about this all the time that it's like, you know, at the end of the day, there's a lot of things any of us could be selling or businesses that we could be working for, but those memories are huge. And it's easy to get lost in the day-to-day and the minutiae of, you know, what your job is. But when you actually sit back and think about that, it certainly gives it a lot more meaning. And I agree with you that I think people are really leaning into experiences more. And that's a great way to get to know somebody also to ask, you know, what actually means something to them. I mean, that's what all this is about. But Katie, you and I we met a few years ago, actually. You, MMGY, pitched the Myrtle Beach Chamber and CVB DMO to be the advertising agency of record. And that's when I first got to meet you and some other people from your team and just got to understand all that MMGY offers and what your company does. And it's robust. I mean, you guys literally do everything within the marketing space that a destination or travel brand could possibly want, from the PR to the digital to the paid to, I mean, anything within the marketing side you guys cover. I remember during COVID, you know, looking at our budgets at that time, and, you know, really thinking about what do we do? Because a lot of destinations, they cut their budgets off, and that was, you know, they just had to wait until things rebounded. But due to your guidance and your team, we kept things going, and it ended up working out marvelously for the destination. And we grew a lot because of taking those strides. But it's been great working with you on Visit Myrtle Beach. And I know everybody, Stuart and the team over there, have really enjoyed working with you.
Well, thank you for your service on the board. I mean, that is a best in class team at Myrtle Beach, at the Chamber broadly. And then the board, the guidance, I think what happened during the pandemic, which is not unexpected, is that many travel brands and destinations became paralyzed of what do we do next? And I really can't say enough about Myrtle Beach and just leaning into where were their opportunities. I mean, that is a destination, you know, that's solely dependent on tourism to drive its economic success. And so obviously respecting local law and, you know, the right thing to do related to managing, you know, this situation, but then also when was the right time to lean in and talk about the fact that, you know, like Panama City Beach, where I know you're at, Annie, you know, it was a destination that you could invite people into because of the outdoor experience, you know, as we began to understand a little bit more about how to sort of manage our way out of the pandemic. So I think leaning into that opportunity, and I think that's where our business shines, because we are lifting up travel as an economic driver for the communities. I mean, our goals and many of the goals of the destinations we work with are to enhance the quality of life for the residents. And so how we're able to lean in and kind of turn that back on in a responsible way was a rewarding challenge during a really difficult period, I know, for all of you making decisions at the top of the organization.
Yeah, absolutely.
You said you touch all facets of travel. So, you know, obviously Alex and I are in vacation rentals, short-term rentals. We're in this like weird space. And one of the things that we've always laughed at is that, you know, we've been around for a really long time. This industry's been, I've been in it since the late 90s. So for a very long time, but there's still so many people, investors, people that are getting into the space that are like, oh, this is this new, sexy, exciting part of travel. And it's really not. But from your perspective within the DMO space and within like, you know, the travel management, have you seen more interest in it? Is it a space that you guys actually have dipped your toes in and are working with clients on?
You know, this goes back to all the things that we learned in COVID is that the travel industry is this complex ecosystem that's dependent on each other. And so vacation rentals are a critically important part of the travel economy. And so ultimately, I know that the discussion between, you know, obviously I know your background, Annie, which is quite impressive, but being with Marriott Bonvoy and now and thinking about how that fits into even the ecosystem of a major hotel group like Marriott just goes to show the importance of that product inside a destination. And so we do, you know, work and obviously funding and talking about all of those things and how funding works, because many of our destinations are funded by bed tax. I think that's been an interesting conversation that over the years and how to track what is an extremely complex and far-reaching system. But everything has to be, you know, the vacation rentals, the hotels, like those are the products and experiences inside these destinations that travelers are demanding, that they want to experience. And so I think having that sort of well-rounded accommodation spectrum inside a destination is really critical to its long-term success. I don't know if that answers it. I mean, primarily we work with hospitality companies. So we do quite a bit of work with Marriott, especially out of our London office on the PR and comm side. We have worked with hotels and resorts that are independently owned. And then we have to, you know, we do work with Expedia and TripAdvisor. But, you know, understanding, I think, how all these things fit together allows us to fit proper strategy with our clients.
Yeah. So on that, just kind of to dovetail off of it, we have another industry friend. I'm not sure if you're familiar with Jennifer Barbie. She has Destination Innovate and she does a lot on the DMO side, but really within sort of the digital marketing space. So kind of an expert, social media, that type of thing. And so I met her years ago when I was on the marketing committee for Panama City Beach, and we've just stayed friends. And it's just interesting to see her evolve. But one of the things that was interesting was, again, through COVID, she was working with some of the destinations that all of a sudden they were like, oh my gosh, we had no idea we had vacation rentals in our market. Like they just weren't aware because they were maybe on the periphery of the tourist corridor, or, you know, they were just operating on their own and through Airbnb and not necessarily working with the destination. And so she saw that there was like this need to bring them in the fold within those markets. And so I think it's an interesting space that we're all in now that the destinations, if they didn't know it before, they definitely know it now that it's a valuable segment of the market that they need to be aware of and take interest in and take, you know, and put them on the boards, you know, have them have a seat at the table. And so I was just curious, like from your perspective, are you seeing that more and more than you did say pre-COVID?
Well, I would say that vacation rentals and the capacity creation that allows for destinations to expand the visitors that they're inviting that are going to stay longer, spend more. And obviously, on the vacation rental side, length of stay is such an upside for many of these destinations. I think the funding model for many of these DMOs is really the question of whether, and gosh, Alex, you would probably talk about this as much as anyone with your representation on the Chamber's board, is that the typical funding models are funded by bed tax. So the livelihood of a lot of these DMOs are about heads and beds at hotels, and not necessarily tied to occupancy in vacation rentals. And I think if I'm being honest, I think that's been the rub of where there hasn't been probably representation of the full ecosystem within a destination, you know, to drive strategy forward for the destination. So I do think, to your point, Annie, that that's changed substantively as the industry has been impacted by COVID. And then as the industry is consistently impacted by, you know, weather events and things like that, where the industry has to come together to rebuild.
Yeah, for sure. I think, I mean, obviously we talk about this quite a bit too, but Airbnb has made just huge impacts on our industry, both as vacation rentals, but also just travel in general. And, you know, what that's done to destinations, that they're trying to find out more and more about the data, how many guests are actually really coming to these Airbnbs. Are they actually paying taxes? That's a big thing for destinations as well. but you guys really specialize in the data side of things and, you know, finding not necessarily the tax side, but I've been working with the key datas of the world and some of the other, you know, providers. But how have you seen that change over the years for what the destinations are looking for and how you guys can bring in those partnerships to fulfill that information?
Well, I tell you what, destinations are so critically important to the communities that they serve. And I think sometimes are not understood, the complexity is not understood in what they're managing, because oftentimes with the, and no funding model is actually the same across these destinations. I mean, we work with the state of Colorado, the state of California, the state of Texas, the state of Michigan. And then we work with, you know, a Myrtle Beach, a Visit Kansas City, a Detroit, a Cleveland. And so the funding models of these destination organizations, I mean, God, there's even talk about, is it destination marketing? Is it destination management? You know, what really is the role that these organizations play, which is vital to the communities that they serve, but we're often spending taxpayer dollars. So the pressure on the executives leading these organizations is enormous to really prove out the value. And that's why, you know, we talk quite a bit about how a lot of destination strategies, especially over the last handful of years, have become more resident centric as opposed to visitor centric. I mean, our job, you know, when we're hired on the scene, our job is to invite overnight visitors into destinations to drive economic impact. And long overdue and right is to talk about if our job is really, if economic impact, what does that do? It really enhances the quality of life for the residents with infrastructure, investments. Is that really taking place? And how do we think about that narrative? The other piece is when we're marketing destinations, you know, we can have the most beautiful advertising and marketing messages. You both know this, but if they don't come into the destination and have that experience, we're not doing our job. I mean,
exactly.
And so I do think the complexity of the role of the DMO has continued to evolve and change. But your point about how important data and insights have been to drive those strategies that get approved on plans for expense, it does come down to understanding where the opportunities are for a market and then understanding how we're bringing in high quality travelers into a destination that really fit the needs of the residents inside. And I don't think we could ever do that without data and insights. And we do a tremendous amount of research work in our travel intelligence operating brand within MMGY, but we also look to a lot of, you know, to key data and to other data sources within a destination to help tell that story of sort of cause and effect.
Yeah, I think the rise of responsible travel has been profound, and just what that means for the destination, not just, you know, making sure that it's not a crazy amount of people that are coming into the destination, but also that the residents are still be able to enjoy a great quality of life. And, you know, we talk about this at our chamber meetings all the time that, you know, people come here and they vacation and they fall in love with it. And then when they move here, then they don't understand that the reason that we can have these great restaurants and attractions and things to do is because of the tourism. So it's like, it's a double-edged sword and how that's presented to them and then how you manage that. But I think there's definitely been a shift, and we've seen it here of, you know, it's not just the marketing that's outside of the destination. It's keeping the people that are here, keeping them happy, because we want them to be the ambassadors of these brands and of the destination.
Well, I've always thought about this. My first experience typically in a new city is in my Uber ride, right?
Or
shared, whether it's a taxi, an Uber, whatever is available. And I talked about this consistently is I love talking to the drivers about, you know, obviously their livelihood is if they're picking me up at the airport, they're glad I'm coming, I hope.
Yeah.
But just talking about their experience and knowledge of the city and their recommendations and things. So you're right, Alex. I mean, just the real ambassadors of the destination brand are the people working in small business and, you know, working in the hotels and in the resorts and the experience that they give. And so that sort of alignment as stakeholders in the destination brand has become more and more important, you know, as the years have gone on, to really telling an authentic story in the marketplace about what a destination has to offer and then aligning with that right visitor to come in.
Another area that Alex and I are really passionate about is kind of like mentorship within the industry, not just within vacation rentals, but just within travel. And so I started out in the business when there was just mostly men dominated. And I think men still dominate a lot of the leadership roles within travel overall. And Alex and I have talked about our experiences were not necessarily full of great women who were like, yes, you're going to be wonderful and let me guide you through. And so I'm curious your your experience coming up, did you have a lot of great women role models and mentors that kind of helped you? Because again, the advertising world, you look at Mad Men. I mean, that's a great example of men, you know, leading an industry. So I know that's like sexy for TV, but, you know, what was your experience like?
I don't think that Mad Men was probably too far off about 25 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah, it really wasn't. But
I do think that, you know, being a serious business partner, I mean, agencies have had to evolve. If you can't be a serious business partner, you're not going to stay on the scene.
Yeah.
As you look back, the sort of the compilation of your years and your journeys through, there were certainly impactful women, but I would say more of the mentorship opportunities I had were men. And I think I have some empathy for some of the women in more powerful positions as I was coming up in my own career, because there wasn't a lot of psychological safety that there could be multiple women on the scene being successful. And so there was kind of that, you know, elbowing or not making room for another woman to come up. I think I felt that pretty viscerally as I was growing up and feeling conscious of it. So I think that's right. And I think that's changed over time. But I feel like I have empathy for those women now when I look back in the seat that I sit about maybe why some of those behaviors occurred, because there just wasn't room. And so now when we think about, and I know the two of you feel this way, that you feel like the doors that we're opening, it's that famous Michelle Obama quote that you turn around, you leave the door open, you pull somebody in behind you. That is our responsibility as leaders in the industry. And, you know, one of the things that was incredibly important to me as I took on the chief executive role, you know, we have a fantastic executive leadership team, but 70% of our workforce globally are women. And to see that reflected across middle management and executive management is incredibly important. And so, you know, we've now hired of our 6-person global leadership team, 4 are women, 2 are women of color. And I think that, you know, sort of representation and leadership of an organization like ours is incredibly important. And I think the richness that's come from that in terms of how we've thought about global benefits, how we've thought about empowering women to build long-lasting careers while starting families and making choices that they want to in their personal lives. That's been sort of the joy of a career, to be able to be in a seat to make some of those decisions to change some things. I joke, I don't know whether it was like wrapping my first year as CEO, but I got emotional in our end of year meeting. I was trying to think if I ever, I clearly never saw my mentor, the indomitable Clayton Reed, who I adore. You know, he never cried in an all company meeting, but God, I think but I remember having, you know, my first child and coming back from maternity leave after 12 weeks and asking, you know, I was still nursing and like, is there a place where I can, you know, can pump? And there was no room. And I remember being just kind of shown to, you know, an old office with old broken furniture inside. And I remember kind of thinking like, when, if I'm ever in charge, it's not going to be that way. And granted, there are laws now that certainly, but it's completely different experience for young mothers in our business now in terms of their leave in terms of how they're getting paid. We have fantastic paid maternity benefits and paid paternity benefits, because obviously the dynamic of a partnership in parenting is sort of set in those early weeks of a child in the home. And then of course there are people building families in less traditional ways that we want to support and celebrate. And so I think, you know, leaves in that capacity, but so balancing those things and creating this environment where people can really see themselves building a long lasting career inside of our company was incredibly important. And then of course the representation at the top and more diverse representation, because it's not just about women. That's incredibly important, I think, in representation in boardrooms, but it's also diversity of thought and life experience that I think has really changed the trajectory of our global company.
For sure. And we all know it's mostly women that make the travel decisions anyways. So that makes sense, right?
It is absolutely true. I will say just last week, I'm seeing this trend, which I love, for holidays and gift giving seasons, you know, people leaning into experiences rather than things. It just goes to what you're talking about earlier. And so we surprised our kids and took them to LA for a Miami Heat LA Lakers game. And we, of course, we rented through a small business, a beautiful home on Manhattan Beach, and and spent the week and you know, had a great experience with those owners. And so it's so interesting because I travel for business and I stay in hotels. And Annie, as I was listening to some of the previous podcasts and love the show, this is the thing about travelers that are really so unique is that we're all things. I'm renting vacation rentals
you know,
times a year. And then I'm staying in hotels 3 weeks out of every month.
Yeah.
All these things. But I take us back to travel when we're talking about the mentorship piece. But I've been very lucky from a mentorship standpoint. But I hope that sort of this next generation of female professionals have a very different experience than the three of us did.
Attention property owners and hosts. If you want to keep those 5-star cleanliness ratings soaring and your guests smiling, listen up. Introducing Turno, your ultimate solution for simplifying and automating the entire cleaning management process. Say goodbye to the hassle and hello to high-quality, timely turnovers that guarantee those top-rated guest reviews.
With Turno, you can automatically schedule, manage, and pay your short-term rental cleaners, ensuring a seamless and efficient operation.
And here's the best part. Turno's cleaner marketplace boasts over 55,000 vetted short-term rental cleaning pros ready to elevate your property management game.
Turno lets you manage cleaner performance with features like auto scheduling synced directly to your booking calendar, auto payments, photo checklists, problem reporting, and even inventory management.
But that's not all. Keep your cleaner communications organized with centralized chat and photo sharing all in one convenient place. Plus, they've made on-the-go management a breeze with separate mobile apps tailored for both hosts and cleaners. And just in case you need a lifeline, Turno's live 24/7 customer support is always at your service. Because at Turno, they're not just a platform, they're your partner in success.
And there's a special treat for the listeners of the Alex and Annie podcast. When you try Turno and its cleaner marketplace, you'll receive a $150 Amazon gift card exclusively as our thank you to you.
So here's how it works. New users can sign up at turno.com/alexnannypodcast. Search for a cleaner in your area, connect with one or more, and then complete a marketplace cleaning. Once you see how easy and simple cleaning management can be, you'll love how much time and money you save, not to mention no more cleaning headaches. Now back to the show.
Annie and I are very similar to you in our early careers too, that we both grew up with male mentors that, you know, really took care of us, but just never had that female mentorship. But I think one thing I've learned is, I mean, you can read as much as you want, you can listen to other people, but until you actually experience something yourself, you really can't put yourself in somebody else's shoes of what something feels like. So I think, you know, having you being there and being very empathetic and you know, leading the team is going to be instrumental for the growth going forward. But I do know it's been, I mean, the first year in a new role is always tough. Annie and I just went through our first year in our jobs, and there's a lot of learning curves. And granted, you've been within the company for a long time, but it can be lonely at the top. And just curious, like, what this past year has been like, and is it completely different than what you were doing before? Or like, what have been the challenges of becoming CEO?
You know, such a great question. I didn't expect it to be as different as it actually was. You know, I was president of the global company for 4 years prior to becoming chief executive, and it had a tremendous amount of autonomy. And then ultimately in the last 18 months of my role as president, it was succession. So I was taking on more of the responsibilities, was able to work hand in hand with Clayton in terms of how he was making some decisions that really are the CEO's job to make. And so I felt like I had this, was frankly so blessed to have the transition that I did, because it doesn't always work that way. Sometimes you're thrust into that seat and then have to figure it out on your own. And I really had about a year and a half to get ready for it. So perhaps in that year and a half window, some naivety crept in of how tough it would be. I then took on the role. And of course, my mentor and friend over all these years, Clayton, was then not in the office. He was quite gracious and like, I'm not going to office here. I don't want anybody to be confused about who was in charge. And at the time I thought, gosh, come into the office. You know, you exude this energy that we were all accustomed to, like that'll be missed. But there was such wisdom in what he was saying, because it was true. He had led the business for so long that without him making sort of a clean exit, he still sits on our board. Without him making a clean exit, it really would have been difficult for me to assume the role in the way that I needed to. And, you know, one of the things being with the company for 15 years, I've grown up with so many of the professionals around me who I just love and respect so much, and sort of resetting those professional relationships when you become CEO, you know, that's incredibly challenging to, because you have to care about different things. You know, there's so much less room for a lot of small talk than there maybe was 5 years ago for me. And I think that does, to your point, Alex, create, you know, a bit of loneliness, because at the end of the day, my job is to keep the business successful. It's, you know, it's the weight of 40 years and now 19 founders, entrepreneurs that started these businesses that are now part of our global platform, that I think about, and how do I continue on that legacy that they've created of hard work and grit and being customer centric always around the business solutions that we provide. And then the weight of 600 employees who benefits and their livelihoods are really around the success of the business. And so finding that sort of North Star, which is really more making decisions that are good for the business and knowing that those impacts reverberate through the staff, has been a real shift in sort of my executive identity. Mm-hmm. And that's been more challenging than I anticipated. And it's not woe is me. I'm so lucky. And I think that's why we talk about it very often. I'm not asked the question very often because people don't feel sorry for CEOs and they shouldn't. But it is an interesting transition as a woman to I think make, and it's certainly taught me a lot about myself and in ways that have been both fulfilling and sometimes, you know, lonely, to your point.
I assume you have a fairly strong tribe around you.
Yeah, I'm going to cry on your podcast now. I think Lindsay Uberoth, who's the president and CEO of Preferred Hotels and one of the busiest humans on the planet, I reached out to her early on, you know, when I knew that I would be transitioning into the CEO role, and said, do you have time to talk? And, you know, making time when you are so extremely busy, which everyone is, I've like trying to get into this mantra of busy not being a badge of honor, because it isn't, but making time for, you know, the people coming in after us and people taking on these roles to sort of share and prepare, you know, people to take these jobs on successfully was such an amazing gift. And I think about people like Lindsay, and there are half a dozen other people that I would mention that were so kind and sort of preparing me for what this might look like. And then giving me advice on, you know, where to go to create a network, not only, you know, my friends and family who could care less than I'm a CEO.
Right.
My children are still screaming at me about where their soccer uniforms are at, you know, like they, and humbling and lovely at the same, time. My friends that have been friends with me for, you know, 35 years, they could care if I was a CEO or if I was doing something entirely different, they'd still love me. I think that professional tribe, trusted tribe, has been something that I've been cultivating for the past few years. And that sort of the combination of both the personal and professional, I think, is how you sort of maintain that energy level to keep moving forward. That is the dynamic, is I feel a tremendous amount of responsibility. I love this business. I believe in travel. You know, while I have business objectives to a board of investors, that there are realities with that, those objectives don't relate to, you know, that 600 staff members, some they do, quite a few that they do. They have to have a why that makes you cry besides EBITDA, you know?
Right, exactly.
The why that makes them cry is the power of travel, to bridge understanding between cultures, to widen your perspective and frame of mind around what life truly is. And I believe in that. Why still makes me cry in leading our business. And I also have, you know, leaned into the aspects of running a successful business and how rewarding that is for leaders around our company that continue to benefit from the growth along with others and, you know, broadly down into the business and for the investment team that's making a bet on us that we can continue to grow and prosper in this specialty of travel.
Yeah, absolutely. I was just out in Vegas earlier this week for a mastermind and with David Meltzer. And one of the questions that he got in the Q&A was, if you could give one piece of advice, what would it be? And he said, always ask for help. And, you know, it's true, right? Because it's like that you feel like you have to go at everything alone sometimes. But people, especially within the travel industry, I would say, are so wanting to help and give. And, you know, Annie and I are very lucky within Vacation Rentals that we've got an amazing tribe of people. But, you know, I think within an organization or whatever it is what you're doing, just knowing that you can ask for help. And there are people that, because they've been somewhere that you haven't been, they do want to give back and they do want to help. And, you know, to the empathy part of what I was saying earlier, you don't you can't understand something until you've experienced it. But then when you have experienced it, it's kind of your duty to pass that wisdom and knowledge on to somebody else who can benefit from that.
I don't know who tricked us into thinking that everybody who had taken on these roles before knew absolutely everything.
Right.
Yeah.
It's like
nobody.
Parenting.
Yeah, exactly.
You learn as you go, right?
100%. You know, I listened to, you know, your first of the year episode, the bonus episode about your words of the year and sort of how that guides you. And my word of the year is curiosity, because I think the mistake that a lot of leaders, executive leaders make in organizations is that feeling that, oh, I get to go a mile wide and a foot deep and just make these decisions. And again, that is required. We do have to make the decisions, the hard ones and sometimes the easier ones, but the curiosity of knowing, being wildly comfortable with what you don't know, because I think about the professionals I'm surrounded by at MMGY Global, the caliber of clients that we're able to work with, and the perspectives that I get exposed to every day. And I'll make decisions and admit I'm wrong. And you know, my position might evolve, you know, over years of time of watching something, you know, play out. And I'm not afraid of that. And I think that to me is the sort of growth of post first year of a first year CEO was of just getting just wildly comfortable with that aspect.
Looking back over 1 year concluded, what would be one thing that you wish you'd known before?
What a fantastic question, Annie.
And there might be five things, but just one thing.
How sacred your energy is, how sacred your energy level is. And really, and there's a graphic I just saw that's like, you know, your to-do list, but what are the things you have to do, you want to do, or other people want you to do?
Yeah, and that's so true.
And I think maintaining your energy level as a leader, because I am so optimistic about this industry, what we're doing to enrich human experience. You know, it sounds very profound, and I think it is. I do, or I wouldn't spend my days doing. I feel a deep passion for what we're doing. I also feel that I was given an enormous opportunity, you know, kind of coming through the company, in which I was told, like, think about your next job. And if your next job is here, stay. And so then I always felt that way. And then I ended up here. But I think when you become in a position of power is natural. People want a lot of things from you. And I think sifting through that to really focus on the most important things so that you can maintain an energy level to lead a global organization, to be excited, to be there personally for, you know, I always have said, you know, you can't find joy in you typically can't. And I want to say there's never, I feel like, an entirely exclusive, you know, way to say this, but in my experience and the people I've had the privilege to lead over the years, you can't find joy in the job unless you find joy outside of it. And so that's why I ask people within the legal parameters of interviewing, what do you like to do? What are your passions? Like, what are you into outside of work? Because those things matter. And I think those personal relationships, how that gives you energy, in addition to professionally how you're given energy, the maintenance of that is also an important part of the job. And I don't think I understood that fully.
That's a great response. I love that. I don't think I've ever heard anybody, generally people will say like protect your time, but I've never heard anybody relate it to like energy. So I think that's valuable. And thank goodness you recognize that now, not 5 years from now.
Yeah, exactly. That's a good point.
You know, we have global agency meetings where we come together, celebrate the great work, you know, celebrate some, you know, individual accomplishments across our team. These are such powerful meetings because you really get the sense of the scale and what we've built and just the enormous talent that sits inside, you know, our company, which is really enabled by the clients who trust us and hire us to do work. But at the tail end of the year, we were having a close meeting. And of course, we're all having conversations about in office, out of office. What does flexibility really mean in this age? All of these somewhat exhausting conversations when you're running, you know, a large organization of how do you not create outliers that put a lot of weight on middle managers who are doing a tremendous amount of delivery to clients. You know, all of these really difficult conversations about continuing to modernize our professional environment and our workforce. And, you know, and hearing all of the things, and I just, at the end of the year, I felt so drained at our end of company meeting, and I never felt that way. And I thought, what is wrong with me? Like, this is such a dream job, a phenomenal company. Why do I feel like I don't know what to say? And so I talked to my chief of staff and who runs these meetings, does a brilliant job. And I said, you know what, I will give me 5 minutes at the end. I'll close it out to get us to the new year, but I'm just going to listen as I would if I wasn't in this job, and just feel inspired, find inspiration from everyone else. And so I did it. I sat there and just, you know, listened to the accomplishments of the year, of the pride people felt in presenting the work that they had done, that, you know, the changes that we had made in businesses in terms of the marketing efforts, how that had grown, you know, the bottom line for our clients, you know, promotions of our clients. You know, our job is to get them new jobs and bigger jobs. Yeah. You know? And so I just felt so inspired. And of course I got up at the end and teared up a little bit because I just felt so proud. But I think allowing yourself to feel in those moments and to figure out how you can show up and be the best leader for your team, it's not this steady path. And I think being human, you know, I talk about being a female leader, but I think being human first as a CEO has worked well for me thus far. And I certainly hope to continue to lean into that as time goes on. I certainly don't want to harden, want to gain more experience, but still, you know, find the simplicity and joy of privilege of the people I serve in the company and the clients that I serve. It's really incredible.
I'm curious, what are the things that you do outside of work that keep you having that energy?
You know, that's a good one. I always, I wish I could say I had some amazing like talent or hobby that I do. You know, I have two young kids, so we do a lot of sports. Like it's just a, you know, kind of busy season of life. This is such a strange thing to share in this forum, but one thing that always calms me, and you both live by the water, so I assume this is something that we have in common, but is water. So hot baths and being in a hot tub, being in, you know, in the summertime for me in Kansas City, you know, being in the water is so calming and centering to me. And I don't think that qualifies as a hobby, but I will say that if I've had a rough day, you know, my husband will definitely be like, oh, are we taking a 3-hour hot bath tonight? And I'm like, yeah,
that's Annie for sure. Annie's definitely the best, the bath one of us too.
I don't know what it is about the bubble bath that just is calming. And I will say that I too, you know, again, not a hobby per se or something that, but something that is sort of refreshes the, and I'm sure you guys have talked about this, is gratitude journaling. Because I think it's so easy when you're in a position of leadership that you're being bombarded with things that are potentially going wrong. That's part of the job. It's what we're paid for. But I think always seeking out even the simplest joys and things to be grateful for just reframes the way you step into a day and move through it. And, you know, as the energy I said, I never want, when somebody walks into my office and wants to talk, I never want to rob them of any energy they have. I never want to say something that's going to bring them, because I'm such a believer in giving and receiving of energy that I really take that into, you know, into consideration. So some of these resets we have. So I think my hobbies are actually just kind of these micro resets in the, you know, in this busy life of young children, a busy job and things like that. I hope to have something cooler to say at some point though.
No, I mean, that's perfect. That's perfect. Yeah.
It's okay to prioritize yourself as a hobby, you know?
Yeah.
It really is.
Right. Trying to figure out how to do that too. But again, I think, you know, we always talk about this, that health being central to what we're doing when we're in high performing jobs. And so I think centering around health too, and of course it's the start of the year, so I think probably many people are having that conversation with themselves of how to have a healthier lifestyle. And because, you know, health sometimes is put on the back burner when you're, you know, when you're a busy professional, and then it's certainly put at the front immediately if something goes wrong. So that's thinking about a lot this 2024.
So I was curious, in the industry, and it doesn't have to necessarily be travel, but I think travel relates to this. What do you think is a subject or an area that's not being talked about enough?
Gosh, that's interesting. I think I would maybe have a couple different answers to that, Annie. But I think first, we're facing, especially in destination, you know, marketing organizations, facing some challenges and some headwinds around funding. I think in the spirit of talking about infrastructure and economic development inside, it's fascinating to me, and I think incredibly important, how tourism strategy is becoming married with economic development. And how do we spend taxpayer dollars in terms of infrastructure? Or do you think about leaning into tourism, which drives ROI that gets, you know, pushed back into infrastructure? And so I think that's something that has been taken for granted a little bit in the tourism industry, as there's been this boom, you know, sort of through COVID and sort of coming out of COVID, the recovery of travel has really exceeded, especially on the leisure side, and you guys know this, expectations. But I think sort of funding models, especially on the DMO side, is going to become talked more and more about openly. I think it's going to become pretty important to protect these organizations and what they're driving in terms of economic development. You know, we're talking a lot about, you know, diversity, equity, and inclusion around our advertising campaigns and how we're thinking about brands. And I think that was something that we weren't talking about as much, you know, 3 to 4 years ago. And obviously a variety of events leading to that need to be on the forefront. But I think that continues to be an important conversation across destinations and what that strategic imperative really means to those groups. So that's a fantastic question.
Those are two great answers too.
Yeah, really.
Yeah, I would echo both from what I see, you know, on our side of the chamber DMO world, but the funding models for sure. I mean, that's definitely something that's top of mind, and we're hearing that in a lot of different areas that we go to. But it really just it takes preparation. And I know when we've changed our funding models and our different advertising programs it's a complex thing here, but it takes planning. It takes a couple years to really get things in motion to make sure that you're ahead of the tide. And especially, I mean, from the legislative standpoint, you know, we're seeing a lot of issues that some of them come from Airbnb, but these DMOs are facing different, you know, the money that's even coming in is different than it was a few years ago, right? I mean, this is not going to be, I think 2024 is going to be a challenging year. I think it's going to be more challenging than 2023. So it's just something that everybody has to be top of mind with. Well, Katie, it was amazing to have you here today and such an honor. We've truly enjoyed just getting to know you a little bit better, hearing about your career and then just, you know, what travel has in store for this year. So thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you guys. I learn something new every single time I listen to the podcast, truly. And again, such a special part of the industry that you both serve and clearly love and are so passionate about. And I appreciate you sharing that with us every week. That's a privilege.
Well, thank you for listening. We appreciate that. If anybody wants to get in touch with you, what's the best way to do that?
Yeah, you know, LinkedIn is always a sure thing for me. So I would love to chat. And if, you know, this is the thing when you come on and you kind of talk about some of these macro topics, both professionally and across the industry, I always seek sort of dissent in perspective. You know, I think this is probably how you guys have grown through, you know, through the years of doing this, of, you know, being challenged and coming to new ideas. So I would love if anybody disagreed or agreed, you know, to reach out via LinkedIn. I'd love to chat.
We'll include the link to your LinkedIn and contact info in our show notes. And if anybody wants to get in touch with Annie or I, you could go to alexandanniepodcast.com. And in the meantime, thank you so much for tuning in, everybody. We'll see you next week.